There's Pan, but let me start with this. Coming here brings back a wonderful memory. Did anybody know him? This was his place, and I remember when it started, and you were talking about Ahak. I remember that too. He was a wonderful man. These are from his personal collection, and he was, well, in those days when CUNY needed somebody like Tom Tam, he was that decent, honest voice on the board. Do you remember him, Professor? Do you remember Tom Tam? He was on the board. And the one, it's a lot of burden to put on a man named Wellington Chen, but Wellington Chen's sort of the new Tom Tam. I loved this guy, and this lecture is in memory of him. Let's start with a game. If you could go anywhere and live in any city at any moment in history, which city would you choose in history? Some people might choose the Florence in the Renaissance or Amsterdam, or here we are in China, we talk about Xi'an during... I know, but I'm getting to Paris. Any other places, though?
Paris
1900.
Yeah.
Friends of mine sometimes say Vienna 1900. Vienna 1900 had a particular brilliance to it. Freud was there, and Schoenberg was there, and Mahler, Klimt, Schiele. Paris 1900, of course, would be lovely. Mozart, Paris, right? Where else? Where else would you like to live? When would New York have been in its prime? The game here, by the way, is kind of a serious game among people in my world, which is the contemporary art world. People in the art world will say, where do I have to be right now to be where the action is? Right? Some people in the contemporary art world will say, anything, everything's going on in Berlin. And there's something about that. Mm-hmm. Most of the people probably in this room would have to say...
Paris in the early 1900s.
Yeah, Paris in the early 1900s. And of course, that would be the answer to in history. But right now, where would you want to be? I think some people in this room might say... Shang. Yeah, many people say, hey, you want to be where the action is in art, you better be in Shanghai. Well, to go back to this... Give me the choice. If I could do the time travel, Paris in the Jazz Age. Paris from about 1918 to 1929. Why do I choose those dates, do you suppose? 1918.
That's when Picasso and...
Well, yeah, we're going to get to him, yeah, of course. But also 1918 in terms of world history. These things go together with history. Yeah, the bloody Russians. the end of World War I, of course. We should be talking about that. We should be talking about 1929 when everybody came home, because 1929 would be what those of you who are in business? The crash, the stock market crash. So there's this little envelope of time when Paris was the place. And this, if you were a little American... Or if you were from Shanghai or Nanjing, this was almost the first stop, even before you went to your hotel. This was a cafe. And why were all the Americans going to a cafe, do you suppose? What couldn't they get when they were in New York, even at the Algonquin, one block away? Al?
Alcohol.
Yeah, that's right. And you know why? This is so weird. This is very ironic. I want you to smile and laugh at me if you want to. My great-great uncle, my dad knew him, and my grandfather, this is my grandfather's flask. My grandfather used to go fishing with him and carry this flask because it was during Prohibition, was the president. Who was the president who passed Prohibition? Calvin Coolidge. Silent. They called him Silent Cal. I'm just laughing because I talk too much, and my wife will tell you anytime I drink too much. And Silent Cal prohibited alcohol. It was called Prohibition. It was an amendment. So one of the reasons you went here was that you could get a drink. Second thing that was going on, I should say, in New York, and it has everything to do with tonight's talk, is that a lot of other things were also prohibited in New York at that time. Luna, you're nodding up and down. What am I talking about?
Dancing halls?
Sort of. Well, it goes together with alcohol, and definitely goes together with the thing that I'm getting to, which is there was a lot going on in New York having to do with censorship. You couldn't, for instance, in 1922, the most important novel in the whole world was a novel written by that guy, him. And it was called Ulysses. And it had one or two dirty little things in it, which I shouldn't say in front of these young girls, but it, you know, had to do with the body and men's bodies, and especially women's bodies, because the end of it is a very, very erotic ending. where she says, yes, I will, yes, 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 you know. And boy, there was a law on the books here that if you were caught with that, or if the postman brought it to your door, you were arrested. New York, New York. I'm not talking now about Beijing because I'm going to go back to Beijing. So you could get a drink and you could read the dirty books, if you call them dirty, and you could look at some of the pictures and movies too. Paris was the place where these things were tolerated. And that becomes a very, very important part of tonight's talk. Anyway, I'm not here. Tell them. This is a new book and it's here, and later on I'll sign them if you'd like them. That's a wonderful Picasso. We'll get to that one in a second. The middle figure in that might very well be Zelda Fitzgerald, dancing with the members of the Ballet Russe, according to a man named John Richardson, not me. This is my other book that I wrote. So I've been doing this for about 10 years now. I've been writing about the Jazz Age. I'm steeped in the Jazz Age. I think I know it, but then all of a sudden I figure out something new that I didn't know. And that's what tonight's lecture is all about. A wonderful, and I mean absolutely wonderful, Chinese painter that got through my fingers on this one. I never heard the name when I was writing that whole bloody book on the Jazz Age. I never heard of Penn. Let's go. People, writers such as F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, would go to Paris just to see where Joyce was eating or drinking, just to see this great man. Also, painters would go just to see this great man. Go ahead and tell me who that is. Picasso. That's Picasso. And he would look at you. I won't do it, Luna. Don't worry. I don't want to scare Luna. And he would look at you like that, with those eyes, like this. And he'd say, I am Picasso. May I draw you? And in a few minutes, he had you both on paper and, you know, in other ways too. His reputation, right? When you were a young painter in New York or in Berlin or in London or in Spain, you wanted to be where he was. You wanted to be sort of, you know, art is a competition sometimes, right, Al? Usually we say intellectual things, creative things ought not to be a competition, but really sometimes it is a competition. Who's the champ? There's the champ. Who's the best pianist? You know, Gershwin was there, Stravinsky was there. Who's the best? Art and literature, when you know the great one is there, you want to be there. You want to test yourself against. This is another one, Gertrude Stein. I'm not going to go too much into Gertrude Stein, but talking about tolerance, talking about the idea that you can just be who you want to be in Paris, and people don't make comments, people don't arrest you for one thing, and people don't look down upon you. Gertrude Stein was a Yotairet. Gertrude Stein was Jewish, and Gertrude Stein was a lesbian. And that was not so cool for her, even in San Francisco, which I think is amazingly ironic now, and definitely not in New York, and it definitely wasn't cool in a lot of the United States. But in Paris, as even Gertrude Stein herself said, if you're an artist, if you're a writer, and you're, especially if you're good, nobody gives, I'm not going to say it that way, I usually say it, but nobody cares. That's, you're an artist, you're a writer. I'll go quickly. But I love this couple. They were Gerald, him, and Sarah Murphy. She was from East Hampton, actually, not too far from where my house is. He went to the same school that I went to, and then he went to Yale. That's too bad. He was the heir. Do you know Gerald Murphy? Do you know the story? He was the heir to the fortune of Mark Cross. Mark Cross with leather goods, now bought by Coach. My wife is putting her hand in her very expensive handbag. But Mark Cross, they were the ones who made the beautiful leather handbags, belts, wallets, etc. of his time. You would like this part. With offices right on Fifth Avenue. And here comes one part of this story, if I may. He was supposed to just go into his daddy's business, make a lot of money, and sit in the corner office right there on Fifth Avenue, not far from here. But instead, he said, I want to go to Paris. I want to go where, and with my beautiful wife, and this woman was phenomenal. The letters between the two, so romantic. I mean, so romantic. She was so intelligent. She herself was a painter named Sarah. Just, and everybody was in love with her. Hemingway was in love with her. Fitzgerald was in love with her. Picasso was madly in love with her. Look. This is what, and I'm sorry, I should go back. He just said, I want to go to Paris, and I want to be a painter. I don't want to run a business. I want to be, sorry, you're a businesswoman, right? You don't like this part. But I don't want to be going to business right away. The war is over. We can drink in Paris. I can meet people in Paris. I just want to be a painter. And this is what he did. Notice the title. Sorry, you're supposed to laugh. It's at the Whitney cocktail, right? It was his daddy's cocktail tray. It was what his father, every single night, his father would mix a cocktail, not too far from here on 57th Street and 5th Avenue. And every single night, this wonderful couple named Gerald and Sarah Murphy would mix cocktails, and out of the woods would come Zelda and Scott, who were living around the corner in Antibes, Ernest Hemingway, Igor Stravinsky, you know the name Stravinsky, not up and down, right? And Balanchine, the ballet choreographer, because the ballet Russe was there, and Coco Chanel, and Dorothy Parker. You know these names a little bit? Dorothy Parker, very, very funny girl who used to sit right around the corner from here at the Algonquin, drink too much and make funny jokes. You would love Dorothy Parker. It would have been a better lecture. Look who Sarah Murphy also hung around with. And there was a big rumor. This is the painting he made of her, and it's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And there was always a rumor, did Sarah Murphy and Picasso, you know, her family, and I know them quite well, said, no, look at the arms. Everybody loved her, but she remained true to her hubby. And also, everybody loved her, and she was everybody's muse. You know that word, muse? M-U-S-E. She was the muse to all of them. Dorothy Parker was there. A wonderful friend, by the way, to all of them. And you and I are colleagues. And I'm going to tell you, Zelda's best friend, right there. Zelda's best friend. This couple, also fascinating. Everybody was very young. They were in their 20s or 30s. She was a little older. That's Ada McLeish. That's Archie McLeish. Do you know the poetry of McLeish? A poem should not mean but be. McLeish, same kind of story. Great story. McLeish in Boston had just been offered partnership in a law firm. You're going to go crazy when I tell you these stories, right? Partnership in a law firm. That means job security. That means lots and lots of money. That means you're in. You're done. You're fine. And he, instead of taking the train home, he walked home through the Boston Common, and he was really, really late. And Ada, who was a singer, said, "Where the hell have you been?" Which I understand very well, because I get that too when I'm too late. "Where the hell have you been?" And he said, "I just couldn't come straight home. I've just been offered partnership." And of course, that should be the champagne. And he said, "I don't want to take it. I want to go to Paris. And I want to be a poet." And he went to Paris. Instead of taking this, he went to Paris. And he became, I think, a marvelous poet. A lot of his poetry is in my silly little book. And the more I read it, the more I wish that we taught Archibald McLeish some beautiful, beautiful things. Later on, by the way, when he came back to New York, he also became a journalist, and he worked at Fortune magazine, which is where I started as a journalist. Al, you knew that. And I used to look up the stuff that he would write. And he also went to the same school as I did, so I like him a lot. Look at that. That's him. You know Hemingway. But you probably think of Hemingway with the beard, right? Old man in the sea, l'auteur. Right? This was Hemingway when he was really young. And he'd just come out of a terrible war. I mean, they blew him up and left him for dead in a church just before this. And in his 20s, he goes to Paris. He spoke better French, by the way, than many of them. And he goes to Paris because he wanted to be where Joyce was. And he wanted to be where the action was. And he also wanted to be in a place, coming back to this in a moment, where his books would not be censored. Because back here in the States, if you said, sorry about my language, you know, damn, you know, tomato, right? If you said damn, I knew I'd get somebody to laugh. If you said damn and you wrote it down, they cut that. If you said hell, they cut that. And old man Doubleday, and I used to work for Doubleday, would not take the chance to lose the sales, and they would essentially censor him. He wanted to be where he wasn't going to be censored. He was young. He was in love with his wonderful wife named Hadley. He hadn't yet met Hadley's best friend, Pauline, who stole him away. Oh, terrible story, I know. Ha, you know. And that was him at that time. Fantastic moment. You know these two, right? Very, very glamorous picture. Do you know this picture? I'll bet you do. That's the so-called Hearst portrait. Only, she was, I think, when that's taken, only 20. Archer. Only 20, and he was just a year older. They became very, very famous here in New York, right in New York. She would jump into the fountains, Duela, all the time. Yeah, real Jokwe, right? And him too, real Jokwe. But I should say this. He was really popular. He was very, very well paid. Xiaojie, I keep pointing at you every time I talk about money. He was the best paid writer in New York of fiction. He had in his pocket, I mean in his briefcase, a manuscript that he'd been working on in a place called Great Neck, Long Island, in a garage, basically in the little study over the garage. And it was the manuscript for a wonderful book that he decided he would take to Paris. You getting this? Take it to Paris, work on it, and revise it under the eye of a man named Maxwell Perkins, whose office is right there on Fifth Avenue, right around the corner. And the name of the book that became that masterpiece was The Great Gatsby. And we don't have that much time tonight because I want to talk about Pan. But if we had a little more time, I would say Fitz could not have written that masterpiece. There they are on the Champs-Élysées. Fitz could not have written this masterpiece, this great, great book here in New York. He would have been partying too hard. He couldn't have done it in Great Neck because he would have been too stupid. He went to Paris. He talked to really brilliant people all the time. He saw great art. He listened to fantastic music. And he became a much better writer for just a moment. And then he sank down again. He couldn't hold that together. I had a wonderful teacher right around the corner from here, Alfred Kazin. And we used to talk about Fitz. And he didn't like Fitz. I don't think he really liked me either. You know, I went to Ivy League school. I went to a prep school. But Kazin once said to me, right here on 43rd Street at his club, he said, I don't like Fitzgerald. I don't like this Long Island Sundays that he represents. But Fitz wrote the greatest sentence in all of American literature. No other American, not Twain, not Hemingway, not Henry James, no other American wrote as good a sentence as this one. It's the last sentence of Gatsby. Who knows it? Who knows it? So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Bah! What a sentence. What a book, actually. Like, we gotta go fast. That's Zelda when she was young. Wow, she was pretty. Sorry. Zelda, I told you, I'll show you some pictures. This.
Zelda may have written that line for all we know.
Or Maxwell, too. Zelda's diaries and Zelda's conversation. You know, the muse is really important. Sometimes the muse gives you the lines, right? Zelda was a painter. And this is one of the cool things about my group that I write about in my book. They all had something else going on. Hemingway was a great writer, but he was a wonderful collector of paintings. Gershwin, George Gershwin, you know that name? Rhapsody in Blue? He was painting too. Many of them were doing other things. Zelda was painting. This is a little bit, oh, sorry about that. This is a little bit later in her life. She showed it at the Algonquin, which is one block away from right here. When she had a show, I don't know if you know this anecdote, nobody bought a painting. Nobody. Except, because her friend didn't want her to have no paintings sold, Dorothy Parker walked in and bought a painting. I like her paintings. Anyway, it was fun. This is Josephine Baker, famous dancer, singer. I like that picture. she was the talk of Paris because of her all-nude revue. You couldn't do that up in Harlem. You couldn't do that in Chicago. So she took her act and she became one of the most famous people in all of the world and Europe. I'll take that off quickly. I wanted to talk about some of the wild ladies, the wild girls of the jazz age. It's kind of a fun time. The first part of my book is called Freedom. And freedom was the freedom to be like her, Tamara Dilimpicka, who was sort of Russian, sort of Polish. In order to get out of Russia during a really bad time, she's very, very pretty. She became a painter in Paris. This, by the way, is her husband, soon to be her ex-husband. It's one of the reasons she never finished it. Notice he's got his overcoat on. Like, Zola, Zola. That's what she looked like. That's a self-portrait. Hell of a good artist. Real wild party girl. Freedom was the order in Paris in those times. And she really represented it. There's Mr. Dilimpicka with his overcoat ready to go. This one was a huge discovery. I'm so glad you're here because you're thinking about writing about the women of the jazz age. Everybody knows Nancy Cunard because her parents owned this. Queen Mary too, etc. Yeah, rich, really rich. And basically very pretty, very, very skinny and very rich. And these were her boyfriends. Watch this. Four Nobel Prize winners. Way to go, Nancy. T.S. Eliot, for whom he might have written the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And he mentions her several times in The Wasteland. Her next boyfriend was Eliot's friend, Ezra Pound. She went to Cezanne's studio with Ezra Pound. Samuel Beckett. Notice the way he sort of crouched in the corner, like... That's the way Nancy, you know, jumped on her boys. Samuel Beckett, who wrote Waiting for the Godot, in Waiting for Godot, he mentions Nancy Cunard 35 times. Totally obsessed with her. Tristan Zara, one of the great surrealists. This is really the way most men came to Nancy Cunard, something like that. And then Michael Arlen, who wrote this amazing book called The Green Hat, all about Nancy Cunard. So Nancy Cunard, and eventually that became a play and a movie called A Woman of Affairs, and that's Garbo playing the role of Nancy Cunard. But Nancy Cunard also was known for her advocacy of African Americans. And her boyfriend was this guy, and many, many other jazz guys, and her mother really hated this. Her mother was really against this. There they are running the Hours Press. And this is a famous painting by a chap named Archibald Motley, and I think that's Nancy Cunard dancing with one guy and looking at another guy. That would be typical of Nancy. Her mother would send the press to catch her coming out of townhouses in Harlem to embarrass her. And this is, she was the muse, just like Sarah Murphy was the muse. Brancusi did this based upon Nancy Cunard. He was also in love with her. But this is what happened to me, and I think you might enjoy this anecdote. Everybody knew her as the girlfriend of all these famous writers. I read in her biographies she was quite a good poet. So I went to the New York Public Library, right over here, the Berg Collection, and I started to read a wonderful long poem by her called Parallax. And it was fantastic. Even the Eliot scholars that I talked to, I said, have you ever really read Nancy Cunard? It was fantastic. Part of it is about the many trips that she made with Eliot, with Samuel Beckett. Heidegger went separately to this place. Has anybody ever been there? This is Cézanne's studio in Aix-en-Provence, in Provençal. It is like a pilgrimage place for people in the world of art. Because this is where Cézanne, and that's where Cézanne was brought up. But I'm going to very quickly do this because you love money so much. His father was really rich. I'm just teasing you, you know that. I'm having fun. Come on, we're having fun in here. His father was very rich. Nancy's father was very rich. She saw in Cézanne a kind of fellow rich artist in certain ways. But Cézanne, the most important thing for you to know about Cézanne, this is the Mont Saint-Victoire, is that time and time again, he would go to the mountain more than 100 times, draw, paint, and he would never quite get it right. And when Nancy Cunard went to see it, where Cézanne lived, she talked about this. Beauty picked in a field, shaped, recreated, sold, and dispatched. Sold. Beauty sold. She would understand that. I don't know. Can I be really honest with you for the night? Maybe we should turn off the camera. She would understand that. I'll tell you why. Some of the black musicians would say, I don't like the idea that you kind of bought me. I don't like the idea that I'm with you, you're with me, because you got all this money, you're taking me to Venice. She didn't like it, and she didn't like the idea too. And by the way, her beauty, she was very, very beautiful when she was a little kid, when she was a teenager. She was in the so-called corrupt coterie. But later on, she would pick up these guys because she was older and she was rich, and it was always this thing. Love to be sold. Love to be sold. The way Cézanne, beauty to be sold. Love to be sold. Anyway, very, very important when we get to Pan. Let's go quicker. This, nobody's ever heard of her, but it was kind of fun to discover her. In fact, I discovered her in a stinky little gallery. It was a dreadful gallery out in East Hampton. This is a nice 19-year-old girl from Brooklyn whose father was in the fur trade, who was studying at the Art Students League, not up and down, if you know what I'm talking about. You do, right? The Art Students League is on 57th Street still. A great, great place to learn art. And all her teachers said, you want to keep going? you go to Paris. So she goes to daddy, nice Jewish girl, goes to daddy and says, I want to go to Paris. And father, how much is it going to cost? And he said, you're going to have $2,000 to go to Paris, but you have to copy a painting, bring it back, and I'm going to give it to my boss in the fur trade, and that's going to be your ticket. She goes to Paris, first day in Paris. How cool is this? She sits at a coffee table, and who sits down next to her? Picasso. And she draws Picasso. I've seen this little drawing. I mean, how about that, right? And then she paints, and this is what she paints. She liked Picasso, but she also liked Matisse. And this is, who said that? You got it. Way to go, Luna. Excellent. She liked Degas and Lautrec. And when she went to Paris, she learned to paint in different styles. Hold that thought, because here comes our star for tonight. And this is the first time I've ever been able to do this lecture the way it really should be done. This is an important story. Who knows about Pan? Oh my gosh, I thought somebody up here would know, right? Ni, Nina?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you know about Pan? You know that Gong Li played her in a movie. What else do you know?
I haven't watched that movie yet, but she's really poor.
Good. Go, Luna. She was so poor that her family...
She was an orphan, then she was...
Orphan?
To the prostitution.
Oh, Luna. Luna did it. Luna said it, I didn't, but she was. She was. Yeah. Luna, ouch, Luna said it and I didn't. She was sold to a brothel, and that's not where you serve broth. 13, some people say 14, she was sold. And a nice guy, her name really was Chen, and a nice guy named Pan kind of adopted her and said, I'm going to teach you to read and write. I'm going to teach you a little bit about the finer things in life. I'm going to get you out of Anhui, and I'm going to take you to Shanghai. And they went to Shanghai. He was a big shot in the government, right, Pingy? He was in Sun Yat-sen's government. He was rich, and he was powerful. And he brought her under his wing. She remembered one thing about her mummy. Do you remember this? One thing, one vague memory she had of her mummy, which was her mummy liked to embroider. So her mummy would draw the pattern, and then she would embroider. And so she wanted to learn to draw, and she wanted to learn to paint. And then it turned out that she had fantastic talent as an artist. This is when she was very, very young. Oh, isn't it fantastic? And I'm going to jump ahead for a second. No, I'll do it this way. In 1922, having gone to an art school in Shanghai where they allowed you to paint in a Western manner. And most important, they allowed you to draw from the figure. You got it? Mm-hmm. What do I mean? Yeah. Draw from... Luna. Nude. Nude. And it's true. And only this school and only this teacher would be doing this. And even though they were doing it at school... When people found out that they were doing it, a crowd gathered outside the school and started to break the windows because they shouldn't be in there looking at naked girls or naked, or much more important, naked men. You ought not to be in there. But you and I know that that's how you learn to paint the figure and draw the figure. That's essential to doing it if you're going to especially do it in the Western way. So, kind of famously, she would go to the bath. To the bathhouse. And she would watch the girls at undress, and quietly she would draw. And one time they saw her. Do you know that story too? And they took her sketchbook and they ripped it up and they beat her and they got her out of there. Then suddenly she won the first major scholarship. This is not the communist government, this is the republic, right? Right, Ping? And so she won the first federal scholarship to go to Paris. The first Chinese to get the... There were other Chinese in Paris. Do you know this guy, this name? Come on. Xu Beihong. This is Xu Beihong. Very good, right? He was there. He'd also studied in the same sort of Western style as well as Eastern style. Xu was there. I like this guy. I don't know if that name means anything to anybody here. Do you remember a pianist named Fu Cong? That's his dad. Do you know a little bit about his story? It's kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, the ending is not so good.
The ending is not so good. He and his wife committed suicide together, side by side in a bed during the Cultural Revolution. It's okay. We could talk about that, right? We're not going to get the camera turned off. This was a really bad story. But before it happened, you know, Xu Beihong was in Paris. Foulet was in Paris, actually going back to the 1916-17. He was in the studio of Rodin. Rodin really liked him. He was writing a great book about Rodin, and he was translating Rodin's wonderful writings. So you had a bunch of really smart Chinese people who were making this trip to Paris to study literature, to study art, to study some music as well. And here's Pan. I think, I don't know about you, but I think it's just such a courageous story. This Pan, on her own, does not go with Habi. She goes on her own to go to Paris to study. And then she draws and draws and draws where some of these other great Chinese scholars were. There she is, in a wonderful, wonderful self-portrait. She draws and draws her way into the toughest school in the world to study art. Do you know this school? The École des Beaux-Arts. Nijiro. Wow, Luna.
I was in Paris.
The École, how do you get into the École des Beaux-Arts? I'll tell you a funny joke. Not a funny joke, a story. Rodin, about whom I wrote a book that's been translated into Chinese, is coming out in November. Rodin failed 3 times to get into Beaux-Arts. And I'm talking about Rodin, the Rodin. It was such a tough school to get into. What else do you know about the École des Beaux-Arts?
I
don't think so. We have to check that. Matisse would have been a very different style. The École des Beaux-Arts, if you got in, you were doing a very classical, precise style. Matisse might, maybe, but he had his own school too. Matisse was much more abstract. These guys could draw, and when you looked at the drawing, it was like photographic. I'm just trying to do the same thing I did with Nancy Cunard, which is to say, this was one of those natural talents as an artist. She was just a natural. Let's look at some of her paintings together, shall we? And I haven't done this. Poor Luna, she's been through a couple of these lectures, and my poor wife here, she's been through a million of them. But I've never done this way, which is let's slow down and look very carefully at one of the great artists of that time, whose name still is not so well known. But by the way, I'm about to change that, because I'm now the director of a damn museum. And when I do my show on the Jazz Age, and it was funny, right? I'm taking a whole room, and I'm going to go bang, 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 bang with Pan Yuliang. I'm going to put her name on the map on this one. Not too many people have known her work in New York. I'm going to put them on the wall. So I think she's terrific. Look at this one, self-portrait. So, by the way, that tone, that color. Let's see who knows their cosmetics. How would you describe that color? Because she used the name of that color as a pun. What would you call it? Would you call it
apple?
Yeah, it's a little coral. Luna, of course. Luna says coral. Pingyin, what would you say? It's something you like to eat. In fact, I gave you one.
Peach.
And you kind of like a peach.
Apricot.
And tell me apricot in Chinese. 快点, 说呀. Qing. And qing also means?
Luck.
Huh? Oh, she's read the book.
Sex.
Hey?
What?
Cool. Oh, like kiss? Oh, great.
Sex.
Great! Even better! I thought it meant luck, but okay, Luna. Way to go, Luna. Where have you been before you came? You probably were at the bar, right? With like a Dorothy Parker. Qing. I thought it meant apricot, but I'm going to say from now on, I'm going to say sex. And look at the way she harmonizes it like this. And now, if you don't mind me doing this a little bit, I'm going to show off. Because what I really like about these paintings that you're about to see, and you're going to see a bunch of them, is that she looked at art with a wonderful scholarly eye. She had been looking, I think, at a chap named Voyard. She got the patterns of Voyard there. She had been looking at Matisse, obviously. She was in Paris. Picasso's there, Matisse is there. Let me give you a couple of others. Look at this, fantastic. This beautiful beautiful, beautiful range of colors will remind you as well of a post-impressionist friend of Van Gogh named Gauguin. Yeah, of course. You know those bright, wonderful tones? A little bit of Gauguin. Lots and lots of Matisse. Come on, come on. Luna, who else? Lots of Gauguin, lots of Matisse. Keep going. Let's keep going. Look at that. Look at the colors that she pumps into that. And by the way, you can't do this unless you could draw really well, first of all. You could see the École des Beaux-Arts in the way in which she draws the face, the eyes, and the hands. She's got the craft. She's got the technique, right, Luna? But then on top of that, she starts messing around. I see back here, Matisse. Go over to MoMA. Compare. The little piano, the piano lesson, the piano teacher, fantastic. And you know, the more I look at this, and the way I did this in the book was sort of, oh, she was a prostitute, then she was redeemed, you know, then she goes to Paris in 1922. But what I really want to do tonight, briefly, if you don't have a chance to see her painting, so I want to introduce you to a really marvelous artist. And look, come on, look carefully at this, for instance. Oh, I'm sorry. This is another influence, I think, on this one. This was a very famous painter in Paris at that time that I think Pan might have known personally, but I can't quite track it. There are not so many great biographies. Her name was Marie Laurencin. She did a lot of sets for the Ballet Russe. Who do you think this is a portrait of? Think fashion. Think fashion.
Coco
Chanel. Got it. Well done. Coco Chanel. Chanel. You know? Okay, good. This painting, as I looked at it, reminded me a great deal. I'll wait for a second for Luna. Give me another French artist, weird artist, like a real Fengzi, a real crazy man. Odilon, Odilon, Redon. Look at the blues. Look at this. Look at blue. Look at Redon. Look at Ophelia. Redon. So I think what she was doing, like so many brilliant Chinese that I know in New York, and here you are, some of you, she was going around Paris. And she was looking at the great artists, Marie Laurencin, right? Redon, Picasso, Matisse, etc. She was going to the Musée d'Orsay, she was going to the Louvre, and she was doing what the wonderful students I know in New York do as well, which is she was absorbing and she was learning. But she was applying herself to this in ways, by the way, that sometimes the Americans were not. This is Pan Yuliang just after an opening. It's a joke. Just kidding. This is where she got in trouble back in China. And now I'm going to tee up on this a little bit, because guess what happened? She goes to the École des Beaux-Arts. She kills it. She crushes it. She's so great that she wins an award. She gets the award to go to Rome. She crushes it there and she gets another, crushes it means she did really, really well. Really, really well. I mean, people literally said, that's the best painter. In the École des Beaux-Arts, that's the best painter in Rome. So guess what happened? She gets invited to go home. Ready? What do you think happened when she went back home? First to Shanghai, later to Nanjing. What do you think happened? Pardon?
She got arrested.
Close enough. She might have been in the Cultural Revolution. As a matter of fact, during the Cultural Revolution, when somebody put one of her nudes up, this was during the time when I was in China and I was a big part of it. Spiritual pollution, it was called. Oh man, I am just the walking, talking spiritual pollution source right here. No, during the Cultural Revolution, they went into the show, they took down two nudes, and they said, you can't show that. That's in the 1980s, right? Now, she wasn't arrested. She got to teach. Oh, wow, what a painting. What a hand. What beautiful flesh tone. Sorry, I kind of like it. Not for the dirty reasons, but because that is a phenomenal odalisque. You know, if you know your painting and you understand what makes a great painting of the figure and not such a great painting, it's that S curve. It's called the arabesque. It's that wonderful sinuous in and out, the way she got the curves. Not just that she could do the anatomy perfectly, but that she could arrange the composition so beautifully. And this one, by the way, reminds me a great deal of a wonderful painter that she would not have known, but she would have known. You said Courbet. No? Renoir, of course. Luna, very good. I didn't say it, but it's good. Renoir, of course. And a great painter of the nude. I was also thinking of a chap named Modigliani. Modigliani. Modigliani was dead, but his legacy was around. Everybody, all these guys and all these women, like Marie Laurencin, would have said, have you ever seen Modigliani's nudes? And that is phenomenal. But no, she goes back to Nanjing. And she's made a professor. And boy, do I know this. The minute she's back, all the kids want to study with her. But all the other professors, nose off joint. All the other professors can't stand this. She won that award. She wants to show nudes. She wants the kids to draw from the nude. So when she had one show, they smashed the windows. They started a riot in the street. They gave her the same old, sorry guys, bullshit that she'd gotten when she left China. The same old thing for the same old stupid reasons. Like nobody takes their clothes off in China. How do you think there's no such thing as the nude body in China? I don't quite understand how you get 1.4 billion people in China if you don't take your clothes off. Maybe it's the Immaculate Conception. But it's that prudish censorship, the same censorship that drove the writers and the artists out of New York was still in China. So she was in Shanghai briefly. You'd think Shanghai, that would be easier, right? Shanghai, big city, a little more sophisticated. Nope, more of that same stuff. So guess what she did? And it's almost sad for me to tell you this story. What do you think happened? She got that reception. She got that nasty response again for her beautiful paintings. One was a nude of a man. I mean, look at this. She brought those back to China, and they smashed the windows of the gallery, and they staged a protest outside. And she finally said, I'm leaving. I can't take it. I came back with all my awards. I wanted to teach my Chinese students everything I learned in Paris. And all I got was this again. You know, the same thing that made me leave China, I'm getting it again when I come back with my awards. So she went back to Paris, and she never went back to China again. And I know some people in this room probably understand this one. And I know that for many people in this room, this is a heart punch. She never went home again. She couldn't go back. So until 1977, she went back home in 28. So 1977, more than 50 years, she never went back to China again. I don't know what we would call her. I was having a chat with my wife about this. Do you call her? The Americans were called expatriates. Right, Al? That's voluntary. You're there, Hemingway's there, you're there to have a couple of drinks, you're there to paint, you're there to spend your money because the exchange rate was really good. I keep looking at you every time I talk about money. The Russians were there because they were in exile. You got it? They were in exile. The white Russians, guys like Diaghilev, were there because they couldn't go back to Russia. They would be killed. And Balanchine, when Balanchine got out, at the age of 22, Balanchine, it was one way. So what was Pan? What was Pan? I mean, Foulet went back and then, of course, died during the Cultural Revolution, again for censorship. Xu Beihong went back and forth and ended up, I think, back in China. Who knows? You probably know. Do you know? Where did Xu Beihong end up in the end of his life? China. But what do you call Pan? Do you call her an expatriate? No. Well, sort of. Do you call her an exile? Let's take a look at some paintings. Do you have time? We're okay, right? 7 o'clock. Can you hang in there for a bit? Good. I'm getting the thumbs up back there. Tell me when you get sick of me. I thought that painting by Pan was superb. But the minute I looked at it, I thought of a French master whose work I love, and we've already mentioned him once tonight. Go Luna, Cézanne, very Cézanne. Watch. That's the real Cézanne. That's it. That's the real Cézanne. That's it. Look at the blue. Look at the way she crumples the paper. Look at the way, even the way the table slants like this. And certainly look at the interrelationship she made between the pairs. I wanted to teach you about Nancy Cunard because I think it's so cool that she was such a great poet. But I also wanted you to know that among these people, Picasso was a big shot, Matisse of course, but Cézanne was God. They thought of Cézanne as being the real definition. The hardest part, by the way, of the book, Al, the scholarly hard part of my book, he's a professor, wonderful professor of mathematics over there, was modernism. How did Gershwin and Cole Porter, how did Picasso, how did they change modernism but using the jazz part? How does modernism change? It was Cézanne that they considered to be sort of the birth of modernism in painting. And look at that, and I'm gonna just say it again. I'm an art critic and I'm a director. I'm allowed to make judgments. It's a very good Cézanne influence painting. Do it. Ha! Very good. She agrees with this, so she gets an extra hors d'oeuvre. Let's keep going. This one really, I really didn't know what to do with this one, because there are seasons that look like this. You know that when she went back to China in probably 1931, just after that, and remember she had lived in Nanjing, what happened to her city? Yes. You were yawning. I thought you were going, Nanjing.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know the word.
We do know the word in English. Shama? In English, we often just say the Nanjing Massacre. And I think, as I try to understand Pan, and there was a very good novel about her, by the way, and there's a movie about her, we'll talk about it in a second. But if I try to understand Pan, I think about what it must have been like to be in Paris, and reading and seeing the images of what was happening to, especially to Nanjing. Nanjing, by the way, is a beautiful city. Anybody been to Nanjing? Raise your paw. Yeah, beautiful boulevards, wonderful bookstores, great universities. Nanjing, we just had that thing about Nanjing at Gouda the other day. Just beautiful, beautiful city. Imagine being in Paris and hearing what is happening to Nanjing. When I looked at this painting, I thought, I wonder, this is Paris, but I wonder what's going on. Because at a certain point, it must have been almost unbearable to be Pan Yuliang in Paris at this time when everything is going so badly back home. Let's go out with more pretty pictures. Sorry about that if I depressed you with that part. These are pictures that remind me a little bit about what Picasso was doing at that time. If I may go back and forth a couple of times more. Here she is. I wonder what that says, by the way. Come on, Luna.
Her name.
Shema, is it? Ah, very good. And look at Picasso at this time. This is Picasso in 1917, a little bit before. This is Picasso's Russian wife. And Picasso's Russian wife, he dresses her up like what? This is a Spanish lady. But this Picasso, by the way, and the one you saw before, these were Picassos that his friends were very upset about. You know why, Luna? They were realists. They were too like a photograph. He wasn't doing the cubism anymore. He was doing very realistic portrait of his wife, making her look Spanish instead of Russian. She was Russian, by the way, everybody. She was a Russian ballet dancer. So look at what Pan is doing, too. Even with the fabric and the embroidery. It's a very, very, Luna, you'll understand this one. It's a very carefully worked painting. Technically, that's a painting that the artist worked on for a long, long time. Let's keep going. Ah, I like these. These are so, all right, they're so sexy, but they're also the line in these. This is the Matisse line. This is that line that Matisse was also using for many of his nudes, including the ones that you've seen, right? Including the ones even with the paper cuts. When Matisse would do the legs like that, she's doing it. But also, I think that she was looking at, I don't know, what else, Luna? What kind of art? What from what place? Urban. Oh, yeah, Japanese prints. Those Japanese prints of the concubines, the prostitutes. Big time. Do you see it? You see it? Yeah. You're an art guy?
No.
Huh? Okay. Look, I also think she was looking at this lady. Yeah, Kasat. Look here. See? And look here. Now look, watch. Look, see? She was so good at absorbing these influences, getting them. And then, now here comes the part that I kind of was looking forward to in this hour and more, a little longer than an hour, but I'm going to give you something to eat afterwards, right? To what extent does Pan remain a Chinese artist? I don't know how to answer that, but I thought maybe I'd ask you. I know the French part of that. I could talk to you a lot about the Japanese part of that, but where do you see Pan remaining sort of inherently Chinese?
Well, the subject is...
Yeah, good. Well done. What's your name?
My name is John.
John, well done. You know, almost always for Pan, she was going to paint pretty Asian girls, almost always, or African American in Paris, or probably African, right? Probably Moroccan. She didn't very often paint Lawai. She didn't. You don't see many redheads as you would with Renoir. You don't see many blondes. you see Asian women and Chinese friends of hers. One was crazy. She was fantastic. I wish I'd met her. She must have been a lot of fun. Named Cece. I can't remember Cece's whole name. But Cece, every time you see a picture of Cece, she's got a drink in her hand and she looks ready to go. And Cece had a German boyfriend. So it's almost always an Asian woman or an African-American woman. So yeah, in the subject matter, what else about this is Chinese in your opinion? Shema? Yeah, right. And her chop. That's true, right? So you don't... What I always find interesting about expatriate writers, James Joyce in Paris, mm-hmm. keeping that Irish brogue, you know, drinking Guinness in Paris, you're keeping that Irishness, right? Sometimes, by the way, you take somebody out of Dublin and he becomes more Irish than he was back in Dublin. Do they? Huh? Luna? You know what I mean? You say to somebody, oh, you're going to go to Paris, and Hemingway, for instance, Dos Passos, some of these guys acted more American when they were in Paris than they would when they were back in New York. I don't know how that happens. Some people I know become more Chinese when they're in New York. what I'm asking about, for instance, is how Chinese is Pan as a painter in your eyes? Let's look at a couple of them. This one, I think, is a fascinating painting. We could spend an hour looking at this. What's she doing with this? These beautiful forms, really weird scale, right, Luna? Really weird scale. Why is this one so much bigger than this one? And what kind of game is being played here? What message is going on here? I guess we should start wrapping up. I apologize. I want to look more at the paintings. You should. Take some time. Pan is now... a little bit more famous than when she was. This was an opera that was done back in China based upon Pan Yuliang's life. And I don't know, did you know? Yeah. Did you know Gong Li did a movie about Pan? Yeah. Of course, Gong Li doesn't exactly look like Pan. But I don't mind watching a Gong Li movie about Pan. She did a wonderful movie about Pan Yuliang. Do you know Gong Li? Huh? You gotta, I would call her, the Garbo of China in many ways. Always with a Gong Li movie, I find, she's always gonna have one scene where she gets really, really angry. Luna, ever notice that? And she takes things and she smashes them. Every single movie. I always thought, if I ever invite Gong Li to my house, which would be a lot of fun, I'm gonna put away my mother's porcelain teacups because there's always a scene where she smashes everything. Well, in the scene with Pan Yuliang, as you can imagine, there is this scene where Pan in Paris becomes terribly frustrated. She never became famous in Paris. She had some shows, and she won the awards, but she never became rich and famous. So there's that one wonderful thing, always with Gong Li, smash, bash, and the whole studio gets destroyed. You know? That's Gong Li. Anyway, it's a good movie if you want to learn more. I don't know if it's really accurate, but it's a good movie, and I don't mind watching her for an hour or so. Here's the funny ending to this lecture, and I'm sorry it's gone on so long. Do you know about this, Luna? Nijida, he's a really big collector. He runs Shema. Well, you sold it. Remember what he used to do for a living? This is so cool, really, I think. Come on, you don't remember? He used to be a taxi driver. Here you go, everybody. Paying attention now. Now he's a multi-billionaire. I think probably he and Ma Yun are about the same in terms of wealth. This guy is doing so well. He's a billionaire. And so he decided at Christie's that he was going to buy the number one painting in the Impressionist and Modern auction. And I saw this thing when it was on the wall. And this is by Modigliani, right? And I was telling you before that I think Modi, as they used to call him, Modi, was a huge influence on Pan. Huge. When you look at Pan, you look at Modi, you look at the two of them. And Modi, by the way, very brilliant artist, but real Jokwe. I mean, literally drank himself to death. He'd ruined his life, his health, everything. So he was that famous kind of tragic example of too much freedom during the Jazz Age. So this guy, Mr. Liu, decides he's going to spend, do you remember how much? $172 million. I'm not making that up. $172 million to buy this painting and take it back to, guess where? Shanghai. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm hoping somebody in this room is right now getting the irony of this. This painting, and this is a naughty painting, I'm just going to say it. This is a nude, but this is a naughty little nude. This is a very sexy painting. People looking at that painting at Christie's were saying, whoa. That's it. There's the nude, and then there's the, you know, the out there. Look at the way she looks at you. That's that look, you know. Well, and by the way, I know that part of the reason why Gong Li wanted to play Pan is not just that she was a great artist, but she was a prostitute who became an artist who did the nude. There's a sexual side to this. Hollywood loves the movie about the hooker, you know, it's Julia Roberts, the whole thing. Sorry. But I mean, there's that whole sexy thing. So here is this very beautiful, sexy painting painted in Paris in the Jazz Age, going back to Shanghai, centerpiece of a beautiful new museum, the same place that drove Pan out. I know. And you know, some of us in this room can do this in terms of history, how China goes through these phases, right? And how China has changed now. Luna, feel free to tell me the whole thing. But I remember China in the 80s, and it was really prudish. And Pan went through China in the teens, and it was prudish, and in the 20s, and it was prudish. And there are times you listen very carefully to Xi Jinping, and there are times when you wonder, when are they gonna crank it down again? When is this gonna be dangerous for Liu to put on the wall? Once in a while China will crack down again, right? But think of the irony of this, everybody. Pan left China because she couldn't put that on the wall. This guy spends 172 million bucks at your office to bring this back to China and say, I'm the billionaire who owns the Modi. That, ladies and gentlemen, is Pan Yuliang, the artist warrior in Paris during the Jazz Age. Mm-hmm. Any questions or comments? Thank you. Thanks for coming. No question. Somebody must have a question, though. John, do you have a question? Comment?
Not yet.
Well, I think
it was a great show.
Some of the questions might be answered by this, and I'll sign books if you'd like it. Arshu Kwai.
When did she pass away?
77, and buried in Paris. And I was going to show you the tombstone. You know, that's always a great way to end a lecture, but it's too depressing, you know. But on the tombstone, as you imagine, is her name in Chinese and the chop. And I gotta try to remember. She had a phrase that she loved to use when she signed her paintings. And let me just try to find that. Somebody here try to think of a good question while I look at this, because it's a beautiful, beautiful phrase. Go ahead. Any questions? Yeah, Al, go ahead.
A comment more than a question.
Good.
Well, I thought this was going to be a lecture. In fact, it was a stunning performance.
Oh, come on. Thank you, sir.
I'm a longtime colleague.
We've known each other for years on the same floor.
I've never seen him teach, but he brings the audience along with him.
Oh, you're too kind.
You know, that is quite remarkable. I mean, you said towards the end that you're sorry for keeping us so long.
Such a nice guy. One of the only things I miss about Baruch is being able to chat with him. Go ahead.
And also, your quoting of the last line of The Great Gatsby actually,
you know it.
Motivates me to read the book.
We could have a long debate, you and I, over a good glass of wine. Some people don't love Gatsby, and some people do. Here's what's on her tomb. Forever and ever toward the Jade Passage. I don't know how to say it in Chinese, but forever and ever toward the Jade Passage. We are at that time of the year, right? You were talking about Moon Festival, when almost all of us were Chinese, we Chinese, what's the poem we like to recite? Lai Li Bai. Jing Ye Si. Chuang Chun Min Yu Gong. Remember? Dito Wang. Come on, do it. I know this poem, but you know what? I know this poem. I'm just thinking about Pan and that poem, and you in New York. And I remember living in China. Those moonlit nights when you wake up and the moon is on your bed. This is the poem, everybody. How bright a gleam at the foot of my bed. Could it be frost already? Lifting my head, I see that it is moonlight. Sinking back down, I thought suddenly of home. Home. The last part of that poem. You getting a little choked up? I am. When you're away from home during Autumn Festival, when you're away from home in Paris and dreaming of home, that's why I am choked up thinking about Pan not being able to return because of the people, the way she was treated, but also thinking about Pan waiting it out in Paris, waiting to hear how Nanjing survived. Waiting and waiting. And every year, she must have known the truth of Li Bai, the truth of that poem. It's not just homesickness, everybody. That's that poem about where's home and how you can sometimes feel even after a long period of time. She was in Paris much longer than she was in China, right? Think about it. But she never, I'm sure, felt quite at home in Paris. Forever and ever going toward the Jade Palace. Sorry, I'm getting choked up. I'm sorry, poor Luna. She's going to get mad at me for choking her up. Good comment. Great question. Questions? Yeah.
Yeah. So she died in 1977.
Yeah, yeah. Buried in Paris.
Did she create until the end of her life?
Prolific and fantastic. And the wonderful paintings, some of which made their way back to Beijing in a wonderful... Oh, poor Luna. Let me give you my hanky. In a wonderful museum for art... from people from Anhui. Here you go, sweetie. Anhui. And that's where you could see probably the best of her work. But I have a few places. In fact, Christie's once sold one. I'm going to track it down. Please come as my guest, completely free, to my museum, Nassau County Museum, when I do the Jazz Age show, because one room is going to be for this wonderful artist.
When will that be?
In the spring. We'll also have a great party with good jazz music and lots of wine. You had a question, Chate?
Yeah. I love the Pan's drawing of the pears. Like, do you know the name of the drawing?
You know, let's go back to it for a second because I love it too. It's the still life one, the one that looked a lot like this one.
I really love
this one. It's probably called Still Life. Sorry. It's probably called Still Life because that's what most of them... And unfortunately, the website from which I stole all these pictures didn't have titles. So I'm not quite sure of all the titles. I know a few of the Pan titles. I put them in my book. But I'm not quite sure what the title of this one is. It's a great painting, eh? I do too. I agree with you. You have great taste. You can come and curate my museum. Yes.
I was wondering if she had encountered the works of Egon Schiele with those.
God, what a cool idea. Let's look.
I see that.
There's Schiele in these. Schiele's around. Schiele's more Vienna, as we both know. But Schiele's around. That's a great question. If I knew more about her biographically, this is what I've got. I've got that novel, which is okay. It's historical fiction. I've got also another essay, which I didn't want to bring up, but I'm going to do it in the interest of being a scholar, and you're a scholar, also from Baruch. There's another person who said that stuff about her being a prostitute may not be right. She probably was some rich guy's concubine kind of thing, right? I don't know. What do we call him now? Say every big Chinese, every Da Quan has a couple of these. Yeah. How do you say it in Chinese? Satieba, yeah, right. Iran. She was probably, but she might not, I mean, the whole mystery of Pan is something like this. Only 14 and working as a prostitute, I mean, it's like all the stuff we accuse China of with Foxconn and making Apple phones that you guys are looking at. Child labor and all that terrible stuff. But the one biographical essay said maybe she wasn't a child prostitute. Maybe she was just this guy's girlfriend. And he had, incidentally, oh God, I shouldn't be teaching you any of these things, but Luna corrupts me. He had another wife, Mr. Pan. And when Pan came back home from Paris and they had the show, I think it was the Shanghai show, and she put up a nude of a man, Mr. Pan said, "We're done. I'm divorcing you. That's it." So Mr. Pan, who had been the one who got her kind of going, said, "I'm sorry, but the nude guy, that's the limit for me. I'm out. I'm going back to my other wife. Sorry. Yeah. Huh? The whole thing is so ironic. It just crushes me. Almost this whole story. No wonder somebody wants to make, no wonder Gong Li makes a movie of it. It's just too good, right? And when Liu bought the Modi, I remember saying, oh, this is just way too good.
But that's something I won't believe that he said he'll quit her because she never really got married to him. He had one wife.
Yeah. And here comes the next question. I'm hoping Luna's thinking about it too, because I keep wondering, what about in Paris? I mean, she and Xu Beihong seem to be very, very close. And what about French boys? Mm-hmm. But everything indicates that she really sort of stayed to Chinese models, Chinese people, except the Africans. But I don't know that much about her love life when she got to Paris.
Actually, her family name was Zhang before.
Was it? I thought it
was Zhang Yuliang.
I think you're maybe right. Dang Yihua.
She changed her.
Oh, she changed. That's right. Because her. Yeah. You're right. Wait, hang on. Because I know her first. I know. Hang on. I just got to look. Chen Xuqing was her name when she was a little girl. Then Pan was his name.
Pan was her husband. So he changed her family name.
Good.
So,
to Pan. And then give me the next name, please.
Zhang Yuliang.
对, well done. Very good.
I thought there may be some paintings do have the signature of Pan Zhang Yuliang. Hao
Jila, thank you very much for sharing that with us. That's three names then, you see, because her first name, as a little girl, she was Chen. Chen Xuxing. Ha. Very well done. Thank you. What's your name?
Eva,
well done. Luna, give yourself extra credit for bringing Eva. John, go ahead.
You obviously have a lot of love for this artist and the subject.
I do.
In the position that you're in, do you think you would be able to launch some kind, or maybe you're already doing it, launch some kind of a campaign to
how do you change
more awareness?
You know, it's a good question. You know, she knows it too. She worked at Christie's. How do you take an artist who deserves some attention and build that? There are market questions, but there are also aesthetic questions, and it's like rewriting history. You and I know that one from a literary point of view. But in this book, I tried it several times. Nancy Cunard, I'm trying to rewrite literary history with that one. Pen for sure. Anna Walenska, I just thought was a really cute and cool story, but I'm not trying to make her look like Picasso. But Pen definitely, and Archie MacLeish. And how do you do something like that? The old ways, you would write a book like this, but I know nobody reads books. or you do a show, which is one of the reasons why I'm a director now of a museum. And also you teach. But now you can't do very much. In my experience, you can't do very much in a classroom. You can't change the course of literary or artistic history that much in a classroom. Nobody's interested. So maybe it's a museum and sometimes it's a gallery. And sometimes it's just some big hotshot collector of art who says, I'm willing to put place my bet the way you'd buy 200 shares of GE, you'd just say, I'm going big on Pan. It's weird, right? Yeah. Right? Am I right, Eva? On what I said? Yeah, go ahead.
Does this gentleman here...
Liu.
I can't pronounce his name.
Liu.
Liu. Is he aware of this artist to the extent...
I bet he is. He's a really interesting guy who had... If I may, do you mind if I do this, Eva? He's got this museum, series of museums, not just one, three, called the Long. We'll go. And you want some fun? But when you read it, remember what I'm about to tell you. The New Yorker ran a profile of him about a year ago now. They sent out Jia Yang Fang, right? She was, Jia Yang is her name, right? What's her name? Fang, right?
Fan.
And she obviously used her charms as a reporter to get him to talk and open up a little bit. But then she went back to the New Yorker with a long story about him personally that made him look like a shambalar, a peasant. What was it? Tuhal. She really seduced this guy into talking about him, why he collects art and spends so much money. She went around his museum. She made some very, very tough critical remarks about the way he shows the art. And then she runs this story in the New Yorker. And it was brutal. It was brutal. Because, you know, he's got advisors. Eva, you want to do this now? Eva's going to tell us more. Have you ever met him?
Not yet.
Not yet? You're going to?
I want want to.
Well, don't bring up the New Yorker. Go ahead, Eva. Tell us a little bit more about him.
No, he has many stories. One of the famous is he bought a little cup of chicken.
Yeah.
From Ming
Dynasty. The Emperor's cup.
Yeah.
Yeah. He bought the porcelain teacup of the Emperor, and then?
And then when he got the cup, he just got some tea.
He put the hot tea in it, and he drank it. And these Chinese people went crazy. Don't put hot tea in a really, really, you know, how much did he pay for that? She wants to know. She wants to know all about the money part. How much did he spend?
George Hachan.
George Hachan.
I think he spent like around 200 million RMB.
Yeah, so it's like. 200 million RMB, buys this beautiful porcelain cup and puts Wuli Hua Cha and drinks it. He's fine. All this stuff is. I used to write this stuff for a magazine called Art and Auction. You know, the people who have that kind of money to do that kind of thing. So that's another good story about him. It's quite a museum. I know I want to meet him because I want to borrow that for my show, please, and then I want to put it right next to Pan Yu Liang. Any other questions or comments? I know I've kept you a long time. Friday night, all these pretty girls, they want to go out and have fun. Yeah.
Just one comment because you showed me Josephine Baker.
Yeah, let's go back to her. I love that picture.
Her son has a restaurant.
Yeah, Claude.
In Times Square.
Jean-Claude, right. Let's all go there right now. That's a famous, famous story. You know the rest of the story about her. St. Louis?
11 children.
There you go. The Rainbow Tribe, she called it. She was Ernest Hemingway, come on, you bloody thing. I'm sorry, it's taking too long. Ernest Hemingway once danced with her. There she was. Ernest Hemingway once danced with her at a cafe. And by the way, Cole Porter was there too. And she's wearing a fur coat. And Hemingway thought, why is she wearing a fur coat in the middle of a cafe? And then he realized that under the fur coat was just Josephine. So sorry. I mean, that was Josephine Baker. She was just it's a good story, right? She was just absolutely fantastic. Look at the smile. Have you ever listened to her sing? We should have some music, right? You should hear her sing too. Very, very high voice. She was a blues singer as well as a jazz singer and a dancer. Terrific picture. The last time, actually, your husband, I think, enjoyed this one. I did a long, long lecture the other day, and poor little Luna had to sit through it, and her husband was there. Her husband's an architect. Ever heard of Corbusier, Le Corbusier? Wonderful architect, goggle glasses like this, real nerd, right, from Switzerland. So I put up a picture of Josephine Baker standing next to Le Corbusier on a ship. They were on a cruise together. And Corbusier, that nerdy-looking Swiss guy with the big glasses, and Josephine Baker. Go Corbu. He was a famous, kind of a wonderful, wonderful stories that you could tell about Josephine Baker. I think your hubby liked that story a lot. I don't think everybody likes that picture, though. We'll take it away. She was amazing, too, and fun. It was a fun time. Who would like to have been there? Me. My God, it must have been fun. But, you know, I'm going to say maybe this should be the last thing, unless you have other comments and questions. It was a fun time. They drank too much. The parties are famous and all the... But guess what? When they wrote wonderfully. Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Jean Cocteau, etc. When they painted masterpieces, some of them. The Woman in White, that's a great painting. Corbusier is creating some of his greatest architecture. Gershwin, Porter, Stravinsky, Balanchine... Boom, 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 you know. It's always easy to say, oh, they were just partying it up, live it up to write it down. But they were also creating some of the best modernist painting, writing, and music of the 20th century. That's my point, and I'm sticking by it. Al, do you have
what counts for such creative genius? Is it just a concentration of people who already had that propensity? Or was it something...
Nah, I think it's partly that, and it's partly what's in the air. You go. It was when he went there that Fitz became a genius. And when he was away from it, he dropped like a rock. it made Hemingway from a journalist, basically, into a novelist and short story writer. Picasso, forget it. Picasso was already there. Picasso didn't need the Jazz Age Paris. He was already Picasso. Joyce is an interesting question, I think, right? What did Paris do for Joyce? Because a lot of James Joyce, as you might or might not know, was languages. But Al, I'm going to say this. I think there's a lot to be said for individual genius, but I think there's a lot to be said for where you are and who's sitting by you. Who's the muse? Who's your conversational partner? Who's going to read you? Who's going to edit you? Who's going to buy your paintings? Gertrude Stein. What are you listening to? You know, what are you listening to? How did the jazz work into this? How did the music work into it? So Al, I think it's partly the conditions. And the conditions were perfect. And then the conditions changed, as we know, and it moved. And a lot of them, as you know, a lot of them, the next place they went was Hollywood. Yeah. The next place they went, they figured, they went for the money. But they also went because that's where all the creative people are going. That's where the artists were going. That's where the musicians were going. The movies are the new thing. Paintings are dead. Mm. See? It's interesting, right? So, Al, that's my answer.
So the partying and the drinking.
Yeah, yeah. Shameful.
Is that sort of an irrelevant adjunct? Or somehow...
She needed it. Pan needed the. I'm going to say the alcohol, not because she wanted to get drunk all the time. You got to loosen this stuff up. She went to the École des Beaux-Arts. That's the most disciplined school in the world to learn how to draw and paint. It's like going to Juilliard. But then when it was time to rock, when it was time to swing, these guys who were musicians there, Gershwin's famous, they could let it go with the freedom, but they also knew how to do it at the easel. So I think the alcohol, I think the parties were part of this thing. They needed that freedom, they needed the order, and they needed the little combination out of the two things.
The discipline
of technique.
Right. Yeah.
You seem to know this as well as anybody. I mean, really, Luna, you seem to know this. The École des Beaux-Arts is like going to Juilliard. You draw and you draw from the figure all day, all night. I mean, they work their asses off to learn how to paint really well. Same thing with Juilliard. You learn how to play the Mozart. And then later on, when it comes time to swing and be a jazz artist, you got it. You got the chops. Good question, though, Al. As always, a wonderful question.
There was so much drugs during the jazz age, right?
There was one drug that they were into, and Cole Porter, talk about censorship, got in a lot of trouble. Louis Armstrong sang the line, I get no kick from... He's got it. John's got it. I get no kick from champagne is the song. I love champagne personally. But he threw cocaine in. And back here in New York, where he wanted that song, the record of that song to be played on the radio, they said, that's out. That's out. And the jazz guys, cope. Not that I'm into that. I like the champagne part. Naughty little Luna. Always bringing these things up. Anything else? Any other questions? Thank you so much for coming on a Friday night.
Thank you.
All right.